Good morning, this is Wendy Bauer reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review. It's November 28th, 2016, and we'll begin on the front page with an article by Tony Reed, Herald and Review staff writer, Decatur Veteran Sends Unique Battleship Home. The Decatur-born version of the good ship USS New Jersey will soon set sail across 822 miles of dry land to drop metaphoric anchor in the most appropriate harbor of all, the USS New Jersey. The two ships look exactly the same down to the last gun turret, rivet, radio wire, and teak deck plank. It's just that they're a bit different in size. The original Iowa-class battleship, BB-62, launched in 1942 and now moored as a museum in Camden, New Jersey, cost $90 million to build in 1942, $13 billion today, and displaces 58,000 tons and measures almost 900 feet long. The Decatur USS New Jersey is a perfect 1/96th scale version of the original, built by master model maker Rick Quinlan in the late 1980s, and now worth well north of $4,500. But don't float away with the wrong impression when we say model. Bearing in mind the size of the original, a 196th version is still pretty huge for docking in the average living room. The Decatur ship measures 9.5 feet long, 17 inches wide, and weighs about 75 pounds without its batteries. The current proud owner, Navy veteran Adam Troxell, has loved having his very own battleship moored in his basement since he bought it 7 years ago, but said it's time to weigh anchor and share it with a bigger audience. So he's made a gift of it to the real USS New Jersey, where the museum staff, used to big things, was still somewhat all at sea when they learned the dimensions of the Decatur boat. This guy over there asked me, "How large are we talking?" And when I told him this thing is 9.5 feet long, he just said, "Oh my gosh," says Troxell, 54, with a smile. But they said they really want it, and they are going to arrange transportation. If Troxell felt like trekking north to the Great Lakes, his ship could actually get underway itself. That reference to weighing 75 pounds without the batteries refers to the power units needed to run the wee ship's 17 electric motors. Not only is its fiberglass hull designed to float, but it's equipped to be radio-controlled and self-propelled via its four propellers. And just to give you a rundown, the crane on the back deck rotates and the helicopter, perched on the rear deck, has blades that spin, says Troxell, who sounds like a proud dad ticking off a favored son's accomplishments. There are two strobe lights back here that work, he adds, roaming over the 32-inch tall superstructure, and it has red and green running lights on the side, smoke comes out of its smokestack, this radar antenna spins, and the anchor goes up and down. But probably the neatest thing of all about it is these main gun turrets. They turn, they elevate, and they fire. You put gunpowder down in here, and at the base of each barrel is a glow plug, and when you hit a button on the remote, the gun goes off. He's even got pictures of it steaming across Decatur's Dreamland Lake in Fairview Park, a cloud of white smoke drifting overhead from the just-fired guns. It's easy to see why Troxell, a 22-year career Navy man and major World War II buff, had his timbers shivered at the very sight of it. He first learned of the model's existence while working as a Navy recruiter in Decatur, and in 2009, he finally tracked down and persuaded the model's owner, Steve Woods, who had commissioned it to be built, to sell it. He was living west of St. Louis by then, and I asked him what he wanted for it. And he said, "I think $500. And I said, "Put a sold sign on it. I'm coming to get it." Troxell has loved and cared for his USS New Jersey ever since, occasionally loaning it out for display at everything from Decatur Celebration to the Macon County History Museum. He has even hauled it along every now and then to illustrate presentations he gives on World War II. Troxell is most anxious to reach today's kids, wanting them to realize that a global conflict from 1939 to 1945 that killed 100 million people might deserve more remembrance than the scant 3 or 4 pages it sails through in their history books. And yet, as the age of the great battleships was eventually eclipsed by more advanced ways to make enemies have a bad day, Troxell gradually came to realize that docking a model ship in his basement that takes 3 people to move wasn't the most efficient way to expose it to public view. He mulled it over with his wife, Laura, and decided it was time to wish the vessel bon voyage and send it to a place where a whole lot more people can enjoy it a lot more often. The Decatur couple cleaned it all up first, however, launching wave after wave of intensive but delicate strafing runs to eliminate dust. "It takes days," says Laura Troxell, 52. "It's all done with Q-tips and dry paintbrushes." They even fed the ship's wooden deck with a coat of oil, and now it looks ready to receive an inspection by an admiral. "Every time I look at it, I see something different I didn't see before," says the wife, who is as proud of the ship as her husband. "The details are really amazing." Her spouse keeps ticking off its attributes, too, and it's as plain as a battleship that he is going to miss it. And then Troxell thinks of all those wide-eyed kids who are going to step onto the real battleship and find a precise doppelganger waiting for them inside. "Yeah, the way I look at it, the ship is finally going where it belongs," he says. "She's going home." And some photographs accompany the article. One has Navy veteran Adam Troxell standing next to the model. And then a close-up, although the model is 9.5 feet long, the close-up shows the intricate details, including sailors waving from the bow, and number of details of the guns. Adam Troxell points out moving parts of the USS New Jersey model battleship, including the radar. And finally, there's a close-up photograph of the heliport with the helicopter referred to in the article with the blades that move on the back end of the ship. And also from the front page, from the Associated Press, wind farm complaints hit heights. Clean energy and environmental interests usually go hand in hand. But in western New York, they are battling over plans to build dozens of wind turbines that could be among the nation's tallest, rising 600 feet above the scenic shores of Lake Ontario. Apex's proposal to plant 70 propeller turbines amid the farms and towns east of Niagara Falls is still in its early stages, but it has generated thousands of pages of comments, studies, and legal documents considered by state regulators. Wildlife groups are concerned the turbines could disrupt a major flyway for migrating birds. Local lawmakers worry about flight operations being compromised at a nearby military base. Residents fret about potential health threats from noise, which are still being studied, and say views could be dominated by structures taller than any skyscraper in upstate New York. "There's nothing this size on land," opponent Pam Atwater said of the turbine towers proposed by Apex Clean Energy. "We're not even really talking about aesthetics or anything like that. But of course it's going to have an impact. The terrain here is flat. You can see for miles." It's a debate playing out as rapidly improving technology for towers and turbines allow the wind industry to move on to increasingly taller structures. Federal Aviation Administration records show that the vast majority of the hundreds of proposed turbines the agency is reviewing for air safety would stand at or just below 500 feet. But two other projects in New York, one in central New York, one in the northeast corner, have submitted plans for a combined 70 turbines from 640 to 656 feet tall. There are several projects with towers topping 600 feet in the works in Texas and Kansas. The tallest towers in the world now top 700 feet and operate offshore in Europe. Charlottesville, Virginia-based Apex, a major national wind farm developer, said it hasn't settled on the turbine size for the project named Lighthouse Wind, but noted that the taller machines offer greater yield. Currently in New York, the tallest wind turbine is just under 500 feet, Apex development manager Taylor Quarles said, but certainly the trend in the industry is to go higher, as the consistency and wind speed, essentially the quality of the wind, does tend to increase with elevation. 70 turbines is the high end of the proposal, he said, and it may require only 50 or 60 of the larger machines to achieve the project's goal of generating 201 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 50,000 average New York homes. There is this phase where what used to be the offshore type of size is now migrating onshore for more wind resources, said Yatestown supervisor James Simon, a wind farm opponent. He said that makes people in his community and the neighboring town of Somerset essentially guinea pigs. Atwater notes that they're designed for offshore use, so there is no place you can go and no one who can tell you what the impact's going to be. Retired truck driver Howard Pierce, whose home in Yates is across a street from one boundary of the project, said he isn't worried about environmental issues as much as the payments landowners will get for leasing to Apex. The number one industry in our town is farming, and the wind farm would give these farmers a steady income every year, Pierce said. This would not depend on the commodity prices. The project is one of the first tests of a new state regulatory regime known as Article 10 for the 2011 law that took the power to approve major energy projects out of the hands of a mix of local and state authorities and gave it to a single state authority, the Board on Electric Generating Siting and the Environment. There is not yet a timetable for when the panel will make a decision. Governor Andrew Cuomo has set a goal of meeting half the state's energy needs from renewable sources by 2030. One of the challenges to that goal has been a lull in wind projects since 2013. Installed capacity grew in leaps from 2000 to 2012 and then stalled, with almost no new capacity added in recent years, according to federal Department of Energy statistics. That has opponents worried the process will be biased toward approving the project. Republican Assemblyman Steve Hawley, who opposed Article 10 and Lighthouse Wind, is giving the process a chance. I'm going to trust that they're going to take, not with a grain of salt, not in one year and out the other, but seriously take the locals' concerns into consideration, he said. And from the front page, an Associated Press article, Sustaining Medicaid Coverage Advocated. Former Arizona Governor Jan Brewer fought her own Republican Party in the state legislature for months to push through a Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. That was 3 years ago. Now, as an early Donald Trump supporter who has his ear, Brewer hopes one of the pillars of President Barack Obama's health care law can be saved as Trump pushes to dump much of the overhaul. I don't know how much of that, and I mean it sincerely, is going to be affected, she said. She added that she's encouraging Trump's administration to look at Arizona's model because it is so cost-effective. Brewer said the low-income population that the Medicaid expansion was designed to cover was one of the main drivers of the law, and she's not prepared to see that group go without care. Nearly 400,000 Arizonans have gained Medicaid insurance since Brewer's proposal took effect in 2014. Arizona is one of 31 states that expanded Medicaid, many of them run by Democrats. Republicans have blocked expansion in the remaining 19 states. Among the GOP-led states that expanded Medicaid, many officials are, like Brewer, strong proponents of the program that has brought insurance to about 9 million low-income Americans who can't possibly afford to buy it themselves. Before the expansion, those people had little access to regular health care, and when they got sick, hospitals were forced to treat them without compensation. States that strongly oppose Medicaid expansion, however, continue to do so. Mississippi's three top Republican leaders have said consistently for years that they believe the state cannot afford expansion, as have Idaho's GOP leaders. Florida Governor Rick Scott called for a complete repeal of Obama's overhaul a week after the November 8th election. Scott has been vague, however, about what should be done about the 20 million Americans who got health insurance through the overhaul, nearly half of them through Medicaid expansion his state rejected. If he doesn't completely dump the program, Trump will be under pressure to allow changes to it to give states more control. Current Arizona Governor Doug Ducey last year proposed a work requirement for healthy Medicaid recipients, premiums and copays, and a 5-year limit on coverage. The Obama administration approved limited copays, but nixed the work requirement and the 5-year limit. Michigan, Indiana, and Iowa also have been allowed to charge premiums or fees, but broader changes requested by some states have been rejected. If it doesn't completely dump the program, the Trump administration will be under pressure to allow changes to it to give states more control. Current Arizona Governor Doug Ducey last year proposed a work requirement. Vice President-elect Mike Pence told Republican governors meeting in Florida on November 14th that Trump would replace traditional Medicaid funding to states with block grants that encourage innovation that better delivers health care to eligible residents, according to a statement from the Trump transition team. Pence, Indiana's governor, expanded Medicaid in his state but got waivers from the Obama administration to implement plans that kick healthy people off the program for 6 months if they fail to pay premiums. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchison said he hopes Trump's election means the state will have more flexibility in how it spends Medicaid money. More than 300,000 people are enrolled in the state's hybrid Medicaid expansion, which uses federal expansion money to buy private insurance for low-income residents. This election means we're going to have an administration that wants to give more flexibility to the states, Hutchison, a Republican, said recently. So this is good news in our ability to get waivers to implement the reform we want in terms of work requirements, in terms of cost sharing, in terms of other elements of reform that encourages employer-based insurance. Hutchison stopped short of saying whether he'd like some form of coverage for those on expanded Medicaid program to continue if Trump and congressional Republicans repeal the Affordable Care Act. But Ducey, Arizona's governor, said recently the discussion is not only about repeal, but replace. We want to see all of our citizens have access to affordable health care, Ducey told reporters in response to a question about the future of Medicaid expansion. That was the objective. That's not where we are. We've got a new president and a new Congress and a fresh start. A spokesman for Republican Michigan Governor Rick Snyder said he plans to work with the administration to tout the successes and advantages of his state's Medicaid expansion. How we continue that success is important, and he's willing to discuss how to do that with anyone who has other ideas to consider, Ari Adler said. As for Arizona's former governor, she said her state's Medicaid program is among the nation's best in terms of cost and provider choice. The program contracts with private insurers to provide care on a per-patient basis. I don't know how you could deliver that population any more services better, more cheaply, than what we've already done here, Brewer said. And from the local page, from Decatur, by Chris Luzvardi, a Herald and Review staff writer, Library adds historical research tool. Researchers, especially those interested in local history, have another tool available through the Decatur Public Library. The library recently added Newspaper Archive to its collection of databases, said Becky Damps, local history librarian and archivist. She said the database offers access to newspapers in print and out of print from around the country, including the Herald and Review. The new database is particularly useful for those interested in older publications, as Herald and Review articles can be accessed through newspapers.com. Newspaper Archive offers access to early local news sources such as the Decatur Gazette and Decatur Republican. We think that the patrons who use our local history room will really enjoy having access to these very early newspapers, Damp said. We're still learning about this tool. We'll pick up more information as it becomes available. Work to shift searches to online databases is accelerating, she said. Microfilm is starting to decay, Damp said. We might not be able to use it in a few years. Often those looking for information in older newspapers are searching for obituaries of relatives or location history when they're considering purchasing property, Damps said. It can be a jumping-off point, said Damps, who noted patrons are frequently referred to the Decatur Genealogical Society for further assistance in researching family histories. Searchers can find the information they're looking for by looking through the entire newspaper pages that are revealed, Damp said. To access Newspaper Archive, users will need their library card, but unlike other databases, it can be accessed from any computer through the library's website, www.decaturlibrary.org. Anyone needing help can visit the local history room when it's open inside the library. Damps and a team of volunteers have been busy preserving more of the library digitally, making use of more space to work since the local history room opened in expanded space last year. The room is located on the building's first floor behind the computers, and Damps said it continues to get more use. Part of their focus is on scanning historical photos, Damps said. Scanning is a lot of work, she said. We started scanning a few years ago and haven't stopped. Damps said the goal will be to get the photos online so patrons can more easily search for them. And from Decatur, Tony Reed, staff writer for the Herald and Review, writes, at 105, avid quilter celebrates life's handiwork. The long thread of years Gladys Martin has seen unwind hit the extraordinary number of 105 with her birthday on Sunday. Friends and five generations of family helped the veteran quilter, and she still enjoys sewing, celebrate with an open house party at the Scoville Zoo's Schilling Building. Cookies and cupcakes shaped like quilting squares lined the walls alongside a display of Martin's own quilting handiwork, as well-wishers lined up to greet the guest of honor. The smile on her face was so permanent it might have been sewn there while she laughed and shared memories. Ask the secret to living a long and clearly happy life. The modest Martin said she didn't know. But all my friends, she said, glancing around the big room at a sea of smiling faces, my friends are wonderful. So maybe that's it. Make good friends if you plan to sew a prolonged path through life. The longevity secret certainly does not appear to be low-fat foods, according to those who know and love the birthday girl. Tara Brown, a great-granddaughter, says Martin relishes tucking into a juicy cheeseburger to get her through lunch. She does treat herself every now and then to one from McDonald's, she said. And I think her mind has stayed so active and alert because she keeps her hands active. She has made our entire family quilts and our children baby quilts. The last quilt she made was at 104 years old for my son, her great-great-grandson. Teresa Spain, Martin's oldest granddaughter at 60, returned to the food theme while discussing her granny's staying power, citing a particular passion for potatoes fried in bacon grease, as well as tomatoes and cottage cheese. She also says her antique relative prefers to avoid men in white coats. She's short on patience with doctors, she added. Gladys Martin was born November 27, 1911 in Lakewood. Twice married and widowed, she raised 4 sons and a daughter and has 15 grandchildren, 33 great-grandchildren, and more than 30 great-great-grandchildren. Retired from Central Supply Department at Decatur Memorial Hospital, she is now a resident at Heartland Healthcare Center. They treat her really good there, said Martin's only daughter, Nancy Brown, 79, who lives in Decatur. She just loves it, and she's always a happy person. And the photos accompanying this article show the birthday girl Gladys Martin in a beautiful purple blouse, showing her hugging her niece Sandra Henney, 80, from Shelbyville. And the next picture shows Gladys Martin saying, one of the joys of living long is the number of friends you make. Here she shares a cuddle with Norma McFerrin, who works at Northton Bank and Trust in Decatur, and knew Martin as a customer and friend for more than 40 years. And from Charleston, home sales up in Mattoon and Charleston. The housing market in Charleston and Mattoon has seen an increase in activity according to Central Illinois Board of Realtors Multiple Listing Service data. The data covers business handled through MLS sales. Including sales by owners brought the figures closer to a flat level, one real estate agent noted. In Charleston, the number of closed units up to October was 189, a 1.1% increase over 2015. In Mattoon, the number through October was 241. This is an 18.3% increase over the average units sold for the first 10 months per year since 2000. According to a report, year-to-date sale prices in Charleston slipped from last month, with the overall average falling 2.1% to $126,488. Median prices dipped as well by 2% to $115,000. Even with a decline in the month over month, the year-to-date average price is up 6.2%, with median price up 12% from 2015, according to those numbers. In Mattoon, the average sales price has increased 4% to $97,533 in comparison to the same period in 2015. The median price has dropped 2.8% to $76,500. The price numbers for prior years encompass the entire year as opposed to the year-to-date sales those years. The data does exclude sales by owners and any other sale not made by agencies that might not be MLS members. The information was listed in a Coldwell Banker report compiling MLS data, which collects information all agencies in the area that are MLS members at this point up to October. And this will conclude the first half hour of our reading from the Decatur Herald and Review on November 28, 2016. We will continue with the second half hour after a short break. Thank you.